Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 1:39 p.m. We're in Belt's Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Friday, March 13th, 2026. Members present are Senator Ray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senators Yunt and Merrick are excused today. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in extending a warm Senate Labor and Commerce welcome to our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Zach Lawthorne. We have six, count them, six items on our agenda today. We will take up first Senate Bill 181, Employee Information Disclosure and Data Sharing. Then we will take up Senate Bill 35, followed by Senate Bill 252, then 249, then House Bill 110, and rounding out today's lineup will be HJR 20. First, we'll take up Senate Bill 181 by the Seafood Task Force. We first heard this bill on Monday of this week when we had a presentation of the bill and took invited testimony from the good folks at ICER. Today, it is my intention to take public testimony and look to the will of the committee on the bill. Here to present a brief recap of the bill, we have staff to Senator Gary Stevens, Tim Lampkin. Mr. Lampkin, welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourself on the record and provide a brief recap of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. As a reminder, this is a direct product of the recommendations of the Seafood Task Force that was active 2024 and 25. Appreciate you, Mr. Chairman, as being a part of that project. This was one of the recommendations chiefly driven from our University of Alaska, ICER, and Department of Labor. I'm here simply to shepherd the bill, and they are the ones that are the most appropriate to speak to it. This is, in a sentence or two, simply a collaboration between the university and Department of Labor, and as I refer to casually as a data sharing project to help them process information that ultimately helps policymakers like yourselves make good decisions. And with that is a general summary of the legislation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lampkin. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor staff? Or of the university, who also has representatives in the room? Hearing and seeing none, at this time we'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 181. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Seeing and hearing no one, at this time we will close public testimony. Questions or comments on this piece of legislation? Hearing and seeing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move to report Senate Bill 181, version 34, Lima Sierra, 0921, back to us, A as an alpha, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing none, Senate Bill 181, version 34-LS0921-A, as an ANIAC, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. All right, we're back on the record. Up next now in our lineup is Senate Bill 35. Our last hearing on this legislation was in May of last year. With us for a brief recap of the bill is my staff, Savea Bieber. Ms. Bieber, welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourself on the record and begin your recap of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Savea Bieber, staff to Senator Bjorkman. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 35 today. Senate Bill 35 amends workers' compensation statutes to define individuals who provide delivery services through delivery network companies as independent contractors, provided they meet statutory criteria. This legislation establishes that delivery network companies are not an employer of delivery network couriers, aligning these drivers with the status of transportation network company couriers. The courier is not an employee if the digital network does not propose specific working hours, restrict a driver from using the digital network of other companies, restrict a driver from engaging in any other occupation, or if the company enters into a written agreement with the driver or courier stating their status.
Thank you very much, ma'am. To provide a bit more information, this bill arose out of the situation which was just described by Ms. Bieber to clear up the idea that delivery network drivers may or may not be employees and contribute to workers' comp. But really, it's become significantly more than that. And we've made changes to the bill, which we'll talk about in a minute, dealing with insurance and making sure that drivers have some car insurance as they are maybe waiting to get a job or not. And we'll talk about that when we talk about the CS and reasons for some changes in the committee substitute. Ms. Bieber, thank you very much. Are there any questions on the bill before we look at the CS? Hearing and seeing none, members have in their packets a proposed committee substitute. May I have a motion, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 35, version 34-Lima Sierra 0330 IS and Ilima as a working document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll object for purposes of explanation. Ms. Bieber.
Changes from version A to version I are as follows. Section 1 is a new section adding AS 2196017, allowing an insurer to issue group or blanket occupational accident insurance. This group or blanket insurance would exclude health care and workers' compensation insurance. Section 2 is a new section amending AS 2196018 to remove language that allows personal insurance to exclude coverage under a policy for any loss or injury that occurs while a driver is logged on to a digital network but is not engaged in a prearranged ride or delivery service. Section 3 is renumbered. This was formerly Section 1 of Version A. Section 4 is a new section that amends AS 2823050A. Transportation Network Companies and Drivers Chapter to add the Delivery Network Company Couriers to the section to require insurance policies carried by either the company or the driver to reflect those of Transportation Network Company requirements. Sections 5 through 11 amend sections in AS 2823050 as well as 2823060 to make conforming changes. Section 12 is a new section adding AS 2823065, requiring transportation and delivery network companies to maintain group or blanket occupational accident insurance if a courier is logged into the digital network company. This section also requires a combined single limit of $1 million for each accident and payment of benefits that would include medical expenses, disability, accidental death insurance, and burial expenses. Section 13 is a new section that makes conforming changes, amending AS 2823070, requiring transportation and delivery network companies to file a certificate of insurance with the director of the Division of Insurance. Sections 14 through 16 are renumbered accordingly, and Section 17 is a new section that repeals AS 2196018B1A and AS 2196018B2A.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Bieber? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand Section 4, the new section there. So does this require the company to cover the drivers or couriers, or could the company require that the drivers themselves carry this type of insurance?
The way the bill is written now, I believe it would be an either, but we are looking into changes to make it so it would be the driver.
The driver, not the company.
Yeah, for the personal insurance. Yeah, or for the car insurance portion, yes.
So is this – may I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So we already have requirements for insurance if you drive a car. This is some additional type of insurance than versus what people traditionally have. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, Section 5 kind of leads off of Section 4, okay. And it's got more detail in it with the automobile liability insurance. And that portion is what is already required, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might have more questions of the invited testifiers than if we hear from someone.
Yep, absolutely. Any other questions? So to clarify on your question, Senator Dunbar, I'll just comment on that. Section 4 clarifies that the company is going to provide coverage when someone is engaged in a prearranged ride. So when someone, if a driver for a delivery network company in Section 4 selects and says, yes, I would like to accept this job and be engaged in a prearranged ride, Section 4 would say that the company would be providing coverage. Then we believe that Section 5 likely is not necessary because we disallow personal lines insurance from opting out of coverage in Section 2. So that's what's happening in new Section 2.
So, Mr. Chair, if I might,
yep,
ask a clarifying question. I think that is what you just described, I think, is what I hope to be the case at the end of this. That is to say, while the driver is engaged in this activity for, let's say, it's DoorDash or Instacart, mm-hmm. they are covered by insurance provided by those companies. But as I read Section 4, maybe I'm misreading it. It sounds like the way it reads to me, it seems like the companies could shift the cost for providing that insurance onto the drivers or couriers themselves. But if that's not the intent, then I'll just continue to read it more closely and ask the companies if that is their understanding of how Section 4 would work.
Yep. Nope, that's not the intent. We have a little bit more work to do on this bill by clarifying what it is that is happening. But the intent is that as we look at where insurance should apply. So we talked last year about there being a desire for accidental and occupational type of insurance while a driver is engaged in a ride. And that the desire is to have that apply when someone accepts a job. However, for a delivery network company, companies would not have to provide insurance while they just have the app on their phone. Their personal lines car insurance policy should be in force up until the point where someone would select a job. That's the desire. Anything further? Okay. Ms. Bieber, thank you very much.
I do have a question.
Yes, ma'am. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if a driver has just finished delivering the DoorDash delivery, okay, and they're waiting for the next job, if they got in an accident between the time they finished the last delivery and the time they pushed the button to accept a new job, then they're covered by their own insurance in that period of time?
Yes, that could be the case.
Because that can be confusing.
It can be, yep. And I know there have been conversations with other folks around about whose insurance should apply when. So let's say that you would accept a job and as a delivery network company. Should the company's insurance apply for the time that it takes for you to accept a job to complete it? I think we feel, yes, it should. But should the company's insurance also provide for some insurance after that job's been completed for kind of the deadhead trip or the return trip back home? I think there could be some thoughts that is probable. However, you'd have to define that as a certain amount of time. So it would be, I think, reasonable to say that you would have at least an equal amount of time by the time when you took the trip. You have an equal amount of insured time from the company to take the trip back home or from where you started. Those are some of the conversations.
Okay. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Hearing no further questions or objections to the CS, I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection? Hearing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 35, version 0330/I, as in Igiagig, is adopted as a working document. We have one independent contractor to give us the perspective from his side today. Paul Desjardins is here to speak with us via the Teams web. Mr. Desjardins, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Council, for hearing me on this subject. I feel very personal about this situation because I am an independent contractor. I drive for Spark, which is Walmart. And on this topic, I drove for DoorDash before this. Some of these companies have a little bit of liability insurance upon their insurance themselves. Walmart passes this buck on to the driver. They say the driver's responsible for the insurance. I think this is wrong. I think this bill pushing through is very positive, and it's going to reflect better for the drivers that are out here doing these jobs and delivering these goods. Just a little bit about myself, Paul Desjardins. I was raised here in Alaska. I left when I was 21, joined the military, served for 27 and a half years, and came home. This is my home, and I love it. One thing I learned in all those years in the Navy was integrity. And upon this topic with integrity, I want to have the right insurance. I want to have the right insurance to cover me should anything happen in that whole process. There is no insurance for Spark drivers. We pick up the load, we take it to wherever we are, there is no insurance. If something happens on that, we are responsible for anything. DoorDash, from what I understand, and I haven't got too deep into them, DoorDash, Uber, Instacart, and all that have their own personal insurance that covers some of that when the driver is in the commercial capacity. Walmart passes that buck to us. And if you get into the carrier policies with the insurance, they call it a rider policy, if you will, it adds to your personal insurance until you take that order, which is something you specified in the bill. So the driver is covered in phase one with his personal insurance. He's covered when he's on the app and waiting as long as he has the courier insurance. Once he takes that order, picks it up, there is no insurance. And I found that to be a problem. I wanted to have the right insurance. I went down that hole with Progressive to find that there's a clause in the insurance policies that state they only cover phase one and phase two of the delivery process. The the employee, or if you will, the employer for the company will cover that for the driver. And I went down this hole with Progressive. I went with USAA. I even got a commercial policy with Progressive. And when they found out I drove for Spark, they canceled my policy. They will not cover Spark. Just a second. Like I said, I went down with the rabbit hole with Geico. Geico doesn't cover it. State Farm won't cover it. I got with a couple brokers here in Alaska. I got one in Eagle River. They won't cover it. Kenai, same thing here. I've been all the way around. There's just nobody that covers us in that phase to go deliver these products. And I did everything I could. I've had a couple of these brokers go down that same rabbit hole. It is verifiable. There's just nothing out there. The driver cannot get the insurance to cover him, and the company doesn't accept responsibility for the driver when he's in that capacity. So we're left out in the cold. And some of the answers I see on some of the forums and stuff like that, or just don't tell your insurance company. Well, integrity comes into mind for me. I'm not going to be dishonest. February 4th, I did. I was on a delivery from Kenai to Sterling, and I crashed my vehicle. And no, I did not claim it. I did not want to. That wasn't my goal. I didn't want to call the insurance company and lie to them and say I wasn't doing a delivery. So I just brought it home, and I absorbed that accident. That vehicle's no longer usable on the road. And it is what it is. I just didn't want to be that dishonest person. I want to have the right insurance. And I hope this bill goes through and forces somebody to take responsibility. Even if myself, I have to buy or pay more for an insurance to get it, I'd be willing to do that just to make sure I was covered. So that is all I have, unless you have any questions. I thank you for your time and your hospitality.
Thank you very much, Mr. Desjardins. We appreciate you being willing to testify to the committee today. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, thanks again, Paul. I'm glad you were able to talk to us today.
Thank you. You have a good day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you. Okay. Any further questions or comments on the legislation before us before we set it aside? Okay, very good. So just to reiterate where we're at in the process in this bill, we're looking to just make some cleanup changes to sections 5 and 6 of this bill and make sure that it meets our intent about insuring people when they should be. So the functional parts of the CS, again, making sure that personal lines car insurance cannot drop folks when they simply just have the app on. So their personal car insurance would cover that part, and then once they have accepted a job, the insurance coming from the delivery app itself would kick in, and that's outlined as well in Section 6. And then I believe that what we will see in our next committee substitute is a removal of Section 5 and some clarifying changes to Section 6. But if members of the committee or the public have any questions about what I just described, happy to chat at any time. So if there's nothing further on Senate Bill 35 at this time, we will set this bill aside for further consideration at a meeting coming up soon. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. We're back on the record now. Next up is Senate Bill 252. With us today to present this bill, we have Senator Klayman online, as well as his staff, Carly Dennis, in the room with us. Ms. Dennis, welcome. Senator Klayman, welcome. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, this is Carly Dennis, staff to Senator Klayman. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 252. The Uniform Commercial Code, or the UCC, is a set of rules governing commercial transactions that has been adopted in nearly identical form by all 50 states. Uniformity of law is essential for the interstate transaction of business. Because the UCC has been universally adopted, businesses can enter into contracts with confidence that the terms will be enforced in the same way by the courts of every American jurisdiction. Alaska first adopted the Uniform Commercial Code over 50 years ago. The last time Alaska updated our UCC was in 2013. And I'll note, I think the sponsor statement had said 2009, but it is 2013. As commerce evolves, the Uniform Law Commission and the American Law Institute periodically recommend amendments to the UCC. Senate Bill 252 incorporates amendments recommended by the Uniform Law Commission and the American Law Institute from 2018 and 2022. The 2022 amendments create a new chapter governing controllable electronic records, or CERs, which includes digital assets like cryptocurrency and non-fungible tokens. The amendments provide for the concept of control of these assets, similar to possession of a tangible asset. The amendments dictate how these digital assets can be controlled and used as collateral for loans. The 2022 amendments update several definitions, including for money and chattel paper, and they provide clear rules for hybrid transactions and choice of law provisions. The 2022 amendments also provide a transition period for the new rules to apply to protect parties who entered into transactions before the effective date of this act, and they'll allow time for parties to renegotiate terms of an agreement signed under the prior rules. The 2018 amendments are more narrow in scope. They seek to resolve a potential conflict governing secured transactions in which a partnership or an LLC is pledged as collateral. If a business or if an interest in a business is used to secure a loan and default occurs, business partners could be forced into business with a stranger. And the 2018 amendments seek to resolve this. 16 other states have adopted the 2018 amendments, and 33 other states have adopted the 2022 amendments. It's critical that Alaska adopt these updates to the Uniform Commercial Code to keep our statutes aligned with the best practices used in the rest of the country. Adopting these amendments will promote commercial activity for emerging technologies and will provide a clear framework for our business community. It will help ensure that Alaska is open and ready for business. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dennis. We appreciate your summary of your short 87-page bill. Mm-hmm. Any questions for Ms. Dennis? Hearing none, Senator Klayman has invited one invited testifier, Mr. Benjamin Orzeski. Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you, Chair Bjorkman. My name is Ben Orzeski, and I'm chief counsel at the Uniform Law Commission. I'm legislative counsel. I'm working to make sure these amendments are adopted in all 50 states. Senate Bill 252 enacts the latest amendments to the UCC. Although it's state law, the UCC has effectively been commercial law of the land in the United States since it became the law in all U.S. jurisdictions during the 1960s. It governs both business-to-business as well as consumer transactions. Some of the transactions it covers in sales and leases of goods, bank collections, drafts and deposits, electronic funds transfers, letters of credit, investment securities, and secured lending transactions where personal property is used as collateral. When you buy products on Amazon or eBay, you don't have to worry about what state the seller is in because the governing law, the UCC, is the same in every state. The uniformity of commercial law is why American consumers and businesses have confidence to do business with strangers across state lines, and it's allowed our commercial markets to develop and to thrive. Alaska's UCC was last amended in 2013. This bill, apologize for the length of it, it will enact this rather large set of amendments from 2022 and a smaller set from 2018 and bring Alaska's UCC statute into the 21st century. These amendments were drafted in a series of public drafting committee meetings over a three-year period. They've so far been adopted in 32 states plus the District of Columbia for the 2022 amendments, 16 states for the 2018 amendments. There's about another seven states in addition to Alaska where these are under consideration. And so my expectation is we'll have uniform adoption again within the next year or two. I want to stress the UCC is not regulatory law. It imposes no regulations or taxes on businesses. It consists mostly of default rules that the parties to a transaction are free to alter by a contract. But unless the parties agree to different terms in writing, then the UCC codifies what are generally accepted business practices into a law that everyone can rely on for commercial transactions. It provides the legal infrastructure to make transactions enforceable under the law, a vital prerequisite for our commercial markets to develop. This bill includes minor amendments to nearly every article of the UCC to address various emerging technologies, but the most significant change is the addition of new Article 12 that provides rule for a new type of property we're calling controllable electronic records, or CERs. That's a phrase that we coined specifically for the UCC, and the reason we do it that way, most of the today's CERs live on a blockchain. Includes things like cryptocurrencies, like Bitcoin, but also other types of digital assets that might be linked to other property, such as rights to electronic payments or smart contracts, access to certain artwork embedded in so-called NFTs or non-fungible tokens. And in the coming years, CERs are likely to have many important uses in the financial and securities markets. We don't use the terms blockchain or distributed ledger technology because we don't want to come back to you again in another couple of years with another lengthy bill. We try to draft using functional definitions so that they'll work for the next technology that also builds on or replaces blockchain technology as well. So that's why some of the terminology is unusual, the controllable electronic records. That said, a CER is a particular type of digital asset. It's an electronic record of data, and it can be subjected to control. And you can think of control in this context as the equivalent of possession of a tangible asset. If you have control, you can use the asset for your own purpose, and you can prevent others from using it. You can transfer the asset to another person. New Article 12 of the UCC does two important things to facilitate the use of these assets in commerce. First, it establishes clear rules for proving who it is exactly that has control of the CER. This is critical because some individuals and businesses are already conducting business using these assets, and there isn't a reliable legal regime for control, which causes unnecessary litigation then when there's a dispute. And the second important thing that it does is it makes CERs negotiable. This means that a person who takes control of a CER in good faith, in exchange for value, and without knowledge of any competing property claim, they can rely on the finality of that transaction. The UCC already has similar negotiability rules for cash, checks, and electronic payments. If somebody gives you money to pay for goods and services that you provide, you don't need to check public records for competing claims. It's going to be the same after this is enacted with CERs. This take-free rule is critical if the CER is going to be able to be used in commerce. In addition to new Article 12, the UCC amendments include modernizing changes to other UCC articles. Article 1 contains general provisions and definitions of important terms, some of which had to be updated to account for new technologies, including not only CERs, but things like electronic signatures and remote notarization. Revisions to Article 9 will accommodate the use of CERs as collateral for loans and other obligations, so banks and other lenders in Alaska will be able to lend against these digital assets with confidence that their interests are protected if the debtor defaults. It also revises the rules for chattel paper, which is a dual-purpose document, serves as both a contract for payment and a security agreement and specific collateral. A common example is a car loan. This bill will facilitate the use of electronic chattel paper as an alternative to traditional paper documents. There are amendments to Articles 3 and 4, which govern negotiable instruments and bank collections. This is to keep the state law consistent with recent adoptions to federal law, which allow you to deposit a check by taking a photograph of it and sending that to your bank. And we want to make sure the UCC rules are consistent with those federal rules. Article 2 of the UCC traditionally governs sales of goods, but not contracts for services. But today, many transactions involve a combination of goods and services. If you're contracting for software through the internet or programming through your cable television provider, it's likely a combination of both goods and services. And there were some court cases that had trouble distinguishing whether or not to apply the UCC to these types of cases. So we try to clarify the rules as to when the UCC applies to these hybrid transactions. Another amendment to Article 9 eliminates a potential conflict between the UCC and state laws governing partnerships and LLCs. It preserves the rights of business owners to choose their partners rather than being forced into partners, forced into a business relationship with a creditor. And then there are many miscellaneous changes throughout this bill. You'll see a lot of just changes in terminology from writing to record, from execute to sign, to go along with the new definitions and account for electronic documents and signatures. So I hope this brief introduction to the amendments is helpful to explain why every state should adopt them, to continue the integration of state laws to facilitate interstate commerce. I ask for the committee's support for this bill, and I welcome any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Orzeski. Senator Dunbar has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Orzeski. I had the pleasure of learning about the UCC in law school and in studying for the bar exam many years ago. I have to admit, I don't have it memorized. In a lot of ways, it's not a very philosophical document, but I'm going to ask you a bit of a philosophical question. We have another cryptocurrency bill or a bill related to crypto before the committee today. If you go back and you read some of the philosophy that undergirds the cryptocurrency and sort of blockchain movement, there is a certain loathsome for government and the idea of government. They use terms like fiat money. They want people to sort of break free from the control of governments and be able to use this. And that's why one of the reasons why it's used in so many illicit activities. My question is, given that philosophy for these things, why should we use the power of government and the state to secure and thus subsidize these assets?
Thank you for the question, Senator, and through the chair, I'll try to answer. I think the drafters of these amendments were agnostic on the philosophy as to whether or not cryptocurrency should be used in whether it should be government sponsored or whether it should be a substitute for government sponsored money. And they took a more practical approach, saying that these are already out there, they exist, and we ought to have laws to regulate them. Part of the problem, I think, with cryptocurrency has been some of the litigation that you've seen where cryptocurrency is stolen or it's used for an illicit purpose. There is no legal regime to – you might get a judgment against somebody who owns cryptocurrency and has been nefarious with it, but it's hard to enforce. You can't really get access to the cryptocurrency. What this does is it brings cryptocurrency more into the mainstream legal system so that it makes transactions enforceable. If you have a nefarious transaction that's been recorded on the blockchain and you're prosecuted for that, then judgment against you, it will specify, you know, who has control of this collateral. It should make the judgments more enforceable. So I don't think this is something that is trying to go around government. The UCC is very much a part of our existing commercial law. And if cryptocurrency and other types of blockchain technology is going to be used, one potential use case, I'll divert a little bit, that has nothing to do with cryptocurrency, but is the issuance of investment securities, stocks on a blockchain, which will make them easier to trade and potentially cheaper to trade. This is a use of the technology that has nothing to do with the illicit activity surrounding Bitcoin, and something that the changes to the UCC will also facilitate. Things like electronic promissory notes that could be stored on a blockchain, so that if you have a car loan, for instance, transaction, and the lender sells that note to another person right now that's traditionally have been done on paper, this will allow it to be done on a blockchain in a more efficient manner. I think the philosophy, I'm aware of it. I know it exists. I don't think that's what this bill does.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Orzeski? Also online for questions, we have Conrad Gunther from Drafting. Any questions for Conrad? Hearing and seeing none, any closing comments, Ms. Dennis?
No, thank you for hearing the bill.
Most excellent. At this time, we will set Senate Bill 252 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Back on the record now, up next is Senate Bill 249. This is our second hearing on this bill. With us, for a brief recap, is the Honorable Senator Kathy Tilton and her staff, Heath Hilliard. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourself on the record and begin your brief recap of the bill.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Bjorkman and committee members, and thank you for bringing Senate Bill 249 back before the committee. As a brief update on the bill, Senate Bill 249 establishes a comprehensive consumer bill of rights for virtual currency transactions, which would include licensing and oversight, which requiring all the kiosk operators that hold money transmission licenses to register the physical location with the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. It also provides for mandatory fraud warnings on the cryptocurrency machines themselves. It sets some transaction limits. In this case, in the bill now, is $1,000 per day with a $10,000 per month limit. It has fee transparency, the fees protecting the consumer so that the fees are not more than they should be. It also allows for the right to a refund should it be noted that there was a fraudulent activity that had happened, and also asks for law enforcement cooperation. So that's just kind of, that's an outline of what the guardrails that the bill would seek to set.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any questions for the bill sponsor or her staff? Seeing and hearing none, we have one invited testifier today, Mr. Flint Barr. Can you hear us?
I can. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Oh. Yes, ma'am, we can.
Sorry, I'm a woman, surprise.
Yes.
I have a confusing name.
We're glad you're here with us. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Clark Flint Barr with AARP, and I'm going to share a presentation via Teams, if I'm able to. Are you able to see this, the presentation?
Yes, we can, ma'am.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. As I said, my name is Clark Flint Barr, and I'm a Government Affairs Director for Financial Security at AARP. In my role at AARP, I advocate for policies to protect consumers, especially older Americans, from fraud, financial exploitation, and scams that can wipe out a family's life savings in a matter of hours. Before joining AARP 2.5 years ago, I worked for a company that built cryptocurrency investigation software, and I spent a lot of time looking at how cryptocurrency is used in fraud and scams. And before that, I was with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where I was an intelligence analyst, and I focused on transnational organized crime groups and the crimes that they were committing on the dark net, again, primarily using cryptocurrency as the means of financial transfer. We very much appreciate the committee's attention to an issue that has become a major driver of fraud losses for older adults, and that is cryptocurrency kiosks. These machines are increasingly used by criminals as a fast, hard-to-recover payment rail. In many cases, they've made it easier for scammers to steal tens of thousands of dollars from victims quickly, often before family members, law enforcement, or anyone else can intervene. And I should say, please jump in if you have any questions as I'm going through this. So why is AARP working on this? AARP has a Fraud Watch Network, which does consumer education and awareness on fraud issues, both for our members, but the general public. We run a helpline for victims of fraud and their family members, and that helpline receives about 100,000 calls a year from fraud victims. And one of the things that we've been hearing from victims over and over and over is that as part of different scams, they are being coerced into putting cash into one of the machines, one of these machines, and then they have it stolen from them. And I want to be clear, AARP is not anti-cryptocurrency. We simply want to be sure that there are adequate protections in place to prevent fraud victims from being sent to these machines and then having their hard-earned money stolen from them. Cryptocurrency kiosks, which often look and operate like bank ATMs, lack many of the consumer protections that we expect from traditional financial institutions. And one of the things that makes cryptocurrency kiosk fraud uniquely devastating is a combination of speed. The money can move from the victim to the criminal almost immediately. Irreversibility, cryptocurrency transactions are not reversible. So once the money is sent, there's frequently little or no recourse for victims. And a lack of meaningful protections at the state level in many jurisdictions. And I think this is really underscored by a number of recent lawsuits that we've seen filed by states like Iowa and Alabama. And I've included on this slide here, the Slam the Scam image is from the Attorney General in Iowa's fact sheet on recent lawsuits that they filed against the top two crypto kiosk operators, CoinFlip and Bitcoin Depot in Iowa. And those happen to be the top two operators in Alaska as well. And in their analysis of transactions, the Iowa Attorney General found that 94% of one of the operators' transactions were the result of fraud or scams. Let me repeat that. 94% of transactions at these machines were the result of scam victims being coerced into sending money via these machines rather than legitimate users using the machines to invest. And for the other operator that they sued, the number was actually even higher. It was 98% of the transactions were the result of fraud and scams. And I think these numbers are pretty horrifying, and they really show the scale of fraud that's happening here and how these kiosks have become the perfect tool for scammers. So I wanted to share some key data points from the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, or IC3, which is the FBI's intake point for fraud and scam reporting. In 2024, the FBI received nearly 11,000 complaints about fraud related to cryptocurrency kiosks. And within their crypto crime report that they publish, they actually called out crypto kiosks because it had become such a trend that they were seeing these machines used by scammers. It was a 99% increase in complaints and a 31% increase in losses from 2023. I'd also note that it's important to understand these figures are a significant undercount. of the amount of fraud. It's best to understand these numbers as a floor, not a ceiling. The FBI IC3 data only captures reports that are made to IC3, and many victims report locally to their police rather than through federal channels. And it's estimated that only 10 to 15% of scam victims actually report to law enforcement at all. That said, for Alaska specifically, in 2024, IC3 received 48 complaints involving cryptocurrency kiosks in Alaska, with reported losses of nearly $1 million. And you can see compared to the 2023 numbers, this is a huge jump. In 2023, there were only 2 complaints and reported losses of $36,000. And I think what these numbers are showing is a really concerning pattern, a sharp increase in Alaskan complaints and reported losses using these machines. I also wanted to point out, you can see on the chart on the left, the different age groups. It's clear that older adults are disproportionately impacted by this type of fraud. FBI data shows that the adults aged 60 and over suffered about 85% of the losses in 2024. So what exactly is a cryptocurrency kiosk? Cryptocurrency kiosks, sometimes called crypto ATMs, Bitcoin ATMs, BTMs, virtual currency kiosks, they're ATM-like devices that allow users to exchange cash for cryptocurrency. There are some machines that allow you to sell your cryptocurrency to the machine in exchange for cash, but the majority of the use of these machines is people feeding cash into the machine and sending it to a digital wallet address that they have provided to the machine. And then the cash is converted to cryptocurrency and then sent to the address that's been provided. They're often located in places like grocery stores. My grocery store has one, convenience stores, gas stations. And they look, you can see 2 examples in the bottom of the slide. They look similar to regular ATMs, which I think can create a false sense of familiarity and safety. At the federal level, these machines are regulated as money services businesses, and they have to register with the Treasury Department. But I'll note that that's not a licensing regime, it's a registration regime, so you have less oversight than you would with a typical financial institution. And I also wanted to note that these machines are different from the larger, more mainstream cryptocurrency businesses that you see advertising it with, like Matt Damon at the Super Bowl. For one thing, as Senator Tilton mentioned, there's extremely high fees using these machines. If you were to exchange your cash for cryptocurrency at one of the larger, more mainstream exchanges like Coinbase, you would expect to pay between 1% and 2% in fees. And the cryptocurrency kiosks charge people somewhere between 7% and 50% in transaction fees, with the average fee somewhere around the 25 to 35% range. So even if you're not a victim of fraud being coerced into using one of these machines to send money to a criminal, and you're simply a normal investor using these machines, you're getting a pretty big haircut on the money that you're putting into these machines because of the high transaction fees. I wanted to show you a map of the crypto kiosks in Alaska. You can see there are 64 of them, and they're primarily in the Anchorage and Fairbanks area. And to go back to the stat we talked about earlier, where in 2024 there were 48 complaints and nearly $1 million in losses to Alaskans, that means for each machine, there was about $15,000 lost by victims, which is, I think, very concerning. So how do these schemes work? The fraud patterns that we're seeing are consistent nationwide. Criminals coerce victims into using the machines as a payment method by pretending there's some sort of urgent problem that the victim can only resolve by sending funds through one of the machines. Criminals provide victims with detailed instructions on how to withdraw cash, how to find the kiosk, how to just deposit the cash, and how to send the funds. And you can see in this picture on the left, which is from one of the attorney general lawsuits against a kiosk operator. These are all people who are on their cell phones being coached by scammers in how to use the machine. So it's a pretty involved scam. And typically it'll work like this. Scammer will reach the victim by phone, by text message, email, social media, or a fake tech support pop-up window. They'll pose as somebody the victim trusts, law enforcement, their bank, a well-known company. And then they create this sense of urgency. You have to act now or you'll be arrested. Your account will be frozen. Your loved one is in trouble. And if you don't pay this fee, something bad is going to happen to them. And then they try to keep the victim from contacting family or other trusted parties by keeping them on the phone and coaching them, which again, you can see in this picture here. The scammer will tell the victim to withdraw cash from their bank, go to a nearby cryptocurrency kiosk because it's safe or it's secure. It's the only way. Another thing we hear pretty often from victims is that they're told these are special government machines that we started using during COVID. So it's a new way that the IRS, for example, accepts cryptocurrency, which of course it is not. And the scammer will provide a QR code or a digital wallet address and stay on the phone while the victim deposits cash and completes the transfer. And after the transfer, recovery of funds is very challenging. Most victims discover they were scammed much later because these scams last for months in many cases. And by then, there's very little that law enforcement can do to claw the money back. Based on the FBI's IC3 report, the top scams that we're seeing these kiosks use to move money are extortion, tech support, government impersonation, and investment scams. And these scams are really designed to trigger a strong emotional response, fear, urgency, shame, so that the victim doesn't take the time to pause and verify. And it's not small sums of money that victims are having stolen from them. The average amount of money stolen from an older crypto kiosk victim is about $40,000. But many people have larger sums stolen from them. For example, somebody who called AARP's Fraud Watch Network, a 79-year-old woman, searched for a customer support number online. And what criminals will do is they will search engine optimize their fake website impersonating, for example, Amazon or Netflix or Microsoft, so that when you look for Netflix customer support or Amazon customer support, you get the scammer's phone number and you call that, not realizing that you're not calling the real company. And in this case, the woman ended up reaching an imposter when she called what she thought was the customer support line and sent over $250,000 via a cryptocurrency kiosk, which was her life savings, as you can imagine. So again, AARP's position is not anti-cryptocurrency. We're not here asking Alaska to ban cryptocurrency or prevent lawful transactions or investment. Our goal is very simple. It's basic consumer protections that reduce fraud, slow down the ability of criminals to drain victims' savings, and ensure that law enforcement has the information that they need in order to investigate. And this includes all of the provisions that Senator Tilton outlined. So we're very grateful to see this legislation introduced. I'm happy to talk about any of these pieces and why they might be important if you have questions, but I know you have other bills to get to, so.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Flint Barr. We appreciate your presentation. And if you could please email a copy of your presentation to us at slac.akleg.gov. It's at akleg.gov. Mm-hmm. So it's slac@akleg.gov. That would be most excellent. Are there any questions? Absolutely. Any questions for Ms. Flint Barr? Senator Dunbar.
Not a question, Mr. Chair, just a comment. I look forward to getting that presentation too, because I learned a lot, but also I can think of some folks in my life I want to send that presentation to. I think one of the good things about this discussion as we're having is this recognition that these kind of scams can happen to anybody, and increasingly they are. And so thank you for this, and thank you for Senator Tilton for bringing this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. At this time, I'd like to open public testimony up on Senate Bill 249. Public testimony will be limited to 2 minutes. When your 2 minutes is up, I will prompt you to conclude your testimony. If you do not conclude your testimony within a very short period of time, I will nod to Mr. Lawthorne there. He's a pretty big deal. I see him on TV like a lot, you know. So I'll nod to Mr. Lawthorne, and he will move on to the next testifier. So this time I'll open up Senate Bill 249 to public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to this item? We have a few people online. We'll go first to Brenda Shilbin.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. This is Brenda Sheldon, Executive Director of the MATSU Council on Aging, through the chair. Distinguished senators, thank you for allowing this testimony. I'm calling in support of Senate Bill 249. As you just heard the statistics, what is going on in Alaska is devastating, and it's only, I feel, going to get worse. And why? Because we now have cryptocurrency kiosks located here in Alaska, and the criminals are utilizing them as a part of their scam. This trend is successful because organized criminals are using urgent emotional situations and grooming to coerce older Alaskans to get cash and feed it into the kiosk. These kind-hearted Alaskans are losing substantial amounts of money, and because the funds are going into a cryptocurrency kiosk, that money is gone. MCOA, along with InfraGuard, have been hosting educational events in the MATSU. Special Agent Josh Castleman of the FBI speaks at these events, and it's called Cryptocurrency the Wild West, as the funds go into the kiosk and, for the most part, will not be recovered. Prevention is the best defense. In the last 2 weeks of holding these events, I have heard heartbreaking story after story of older Alaskans being scammed right here in the MATSU by these organized criminals. Too many have lost their entire savings and will now need the state of Alaska to support them for the remainder of their lives. These seniors are embarrassed and they're devastated. We must put in place common sense guardrails to ensure cryptocurrency kiosks do not continue to be a part of an organized criminal ring that is stealing from our older Alaskans. And I thank you for this testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Shelbin. We'll go next to Mr. Chris Edwards. Please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Edwards, and I'm Assistant General Counsel at Bitcoin Depot. I'm testifying today to oppose the bill, and the reason why is this bill, as written, would put the virtual currency kiosk industry in the state of Alaska out of business. So briefly, virtual currency kiosks, they allow people the ability to convert cash directly into crypto. You've heard today about the crypto economy, and there's a number of amazing things that crypto economy can do. If you think about that crypto economy and the ways in which it's being used today, such as tokenizing assets, making payments more cheaply, and doing a number of things, then the ability to convert cash directly into crypto makes sense. And that's why we have a number of legitimate customers who are using that service in order to invest in crypto directly via cash. For example, our customer base includes those who are very cash heavy, so those in the service industries, those in the trades, and they use that service to convert cash directly into crypto. As I said, this bill as written would put the virtual currency kiosk industry out of business in the state of Alaska. And there's a number of reasons why that is. I know I'm time limited, so I can't get into every single one of those. But our bottom line, there is a way to craft a regulatory regime like this that fights the fraud, that stops the bad actors, but that also allows the legitimate operators to thrive and continue to do business. And so what we would ask is that you look at a balanced bill that would both establish consumer protection, but also allow legitimate business to operate. I'll pause there. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, Phyllis Silverton.
Thank you. My name is Phyllis Silverton, and I am a victim of a scam about three or four weeks ago. where I lost $8,000. It was an emotional scam. My daughter was in, had a traffic accident. She was in trouble. My brain switched to mom. And had there been something on the kiosk itself or within it that would have snapped me back, I wouldn't have put the $8,000 in there. But there was nothing that that caused me to think twice about what I was doing when I was finally at the kiosk. These people are very, very good. They do their homework. They know who you are. They know where you are. And they managed to clone my child's voice so that when I answered the phone, I heard my child's voice calling for help. I support the bill, and I sincerely hope that nobody else gets scammed as I have been. It is embarrassing, but it happens, and it's almost a year's worth of house payments for me. So I ask that we support this bill and try to get the criminals under control. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Silverton. We think your child is pretty great. We'll go next to Clara Wilson.
Hello, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Clara Wolfson, and I am legislative counsel for CoinFlip, a cryptocurrency kiosk company. I'm here today to speak mostly in support of the bill. Due to some of the reasons that you all have heard here today, there are consumer protection measures that should be taken on the state level to address some of the issues. And that's why we are supportive of the majority of the bill, including and up to those warnings that were just mentioned. One of the things that I want to make sure I point out is the fee cap in this bill is incredibly low. It's set at 3%, which would tie Alaska for the lowest state in the country. And that just makes business for us really tough in the state. And in fact, it makes it untenable. And I don't want to repeat the potential benefits that Mr. Edwards referenced and access that these machines provide for a certain population of people, but there is a balanced approach that we can take to get there. So I would just urge some more discussion on this bill. And like I said, support the majority of it completely. Support the direction. Thank you for bringing it forward. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wilson. Any questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the room or online who would like to testify to this item? Seeing and hearing none, at this time we will close public testimony on Senate Bill 249. Also joining us online for questions, we have Sergeant Nathan Bucknell of the Troopers, Bureau of Investigations Technical Crimes Unit, Officer Matt Moore from the Palmer Police Department, Ian Engelbeck, Assistant AG with the Consumer Protection Unit at the Department of Law, Director Tracy Reno with the Division of Banking and Securities, Dean Fleer, Financial Examiner of the Division of Banking and Securities, Autumn Miller, who is the Acting Chief of Examinations at the Division of Banking and Securities. Are there any questions for any of these fine folks? We greatly appreciate all of you joining us today. And I don't think we have any questions at this time, but we appreciate you being available. And if we have questions, we will probably submit them in writing at a later date. Are there any further questions for the bill sponsor or staff from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, at this time we will set Senate Bill 249 aside for further consideration at a future meeting coming soon. We are highly likely to bring this up early next week under bills previously heard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. All right, we're back on the record. It's 2:50 p.m. Now we have House Bill 110 with us to present the bill, the Honorable Representative Andrew Gray and his staff, Kyle Johansson. Gentlemen, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of committee for hearing House Bill 110 today. House Bill 110 seeks to increase the number of social workers in Alaska by having Alaska join a multi-state social worker licensing compact. This effort aims to address the urgent and growing need for qualified social workers in Alaska as quickly as possible. Alaska is currently experiencing a critical shortage of social workers across various sectors, including mental health, education, and services for our most vulnerable populations. In fact, the state projects a 13% increase in demand for social workers over the next 3 years. This bill would help to address that. This bill has, we have no opposition to the bill. The bill was brought forth at the request of the National Association of Social Workers Alaska, and I'm happy to present the bill to committee today. Thank you.
Very good. Are there any questions from committee members for the bill sponsor? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the fiscal notes here. I see two zeros. My question is that all of them? And also, some of the other compacts, there are fees associated and then also potentially fees lost by the state. And so with some of the other compacts, at least, I believe there are fiscal notes. Is there some reason this one is different? Is there kind of a different nature between this and other compacts that you know about?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, I will refer to my staff, Mr. Kyle Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kyle Johansson, staff to Representative Gray. As you know, we don't prepare those fiscal notes. It's our understanding that there is no cost associated with this. So fiscal notes are complete and accurate.
Yeah.
Senator Dunbar.
Chair. Are there any fees that the state will be foregoing if we enter into this compact? Any, you know, licensing fees?
Senator Dunbar, I think we have invited testimony today, and I think that they may be in the best position to answer that question.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I also note that Sylvan Robb is also in the audience, and I'm sure she'd be more than happy to assist us in this matter. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for noting that. Very good. Any further questions for the bill sponsor or his staff? Okay. The bill sponsor has invited two invited testifiers on Teams to speak to the bill. First up, we have Caitlin Bison. Thank you very much for joining us today. Ma'am, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Caitlin Bison with the Council of State Governments. I wanted to express my appreciation for your consideration of the Social Work Licensure Compact. CSG, through its National Center for Interstate Compacts, has facilitated the development process for all of the active interstate licensing compacts, including the two that Alaska is already a member of. This compact, the Social Work Compact, seeks to provide licensees with opportunities for multi-state practice, support relocating practitioners, foster workforce development by reducing unnecessary licensure burdens. This compact was created through cooperative agreement between the Department of War and the Council of State Governments. And this compact is similar in form and function to the other two licensing compacts that Alaska is a member of. A social worker must hold an active unencumbered license in their home state to be eligible for a multi-state license. Licensees must also pass background check and meet other eligibility requirements related to education and examinations. From a regulatory perspective, the compact preserves the authority of each compact member state to protect the public health and safety through the existing regulatory structure. So a licensee practicing under a multi-state license must abide by the laws, regulations, and rules that govern the practice of social work in the state where the client is located. And the Alaska Board of Social Work Examiners would have jurisdiction over anyone practicing in Alaska under a multi-state license. So like all these other licensing compacts, this compact will be governed by a commission Currently, that commission is made up of 32 member states. And if enacted in Alaska, a representative from the Board of Social Work Examiners would serve as a delegate on this commission and have an equal voice in voting on the compact's rules and bylaws. So overall, the compact will increase licensure portability for social workers in Alaska, support military families, and improve access to social work services for Alaska residents while maintaining the current system of state licensure. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions, including the one that was stated earlier. Thank you.
Ms. Bison, thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the entity that will govern this compact, the commission, does the state have to pay any money to be a part of it? How does it where does it get the funds it needs to function?
Yeah, so this commission is made up of representatives from the state. Their main cost for kind of becoming operational is the creation of a shared data system that will share licensure information between states. Usually we see that upfront cost of building the data system be covered by something like a professional or a board association. And there may be costs with states getting onboarded to that data system eventually, but we have seen that be fairly minimal. You could definitely see from experience with the ASLP compact in Alaska what that may have cost them, since I believe they're further along in that process. The social work compact has not yet created that data system, so we're it's not yet clear what that cost will be, but again, we have seen that be fairly minimal in other states.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions for Ms. Bison? Thank you very much for your testimony today. We appreciate it greatly. Up next, again via the Teams web, is Mr. Dwayne Brejak. Mr. Brejak, welcome. Please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. Noon, Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Brejak, and I'm a licensed social worker and serve as the executive director of the National Association of Social Workers Alaska chapter. On behalf of NASW Alaska and the nearly 1,200 licensed social workers serving communities across the state, I appreciate this opportunity to testify in support of the Social Work Licensing Compact and the passage of HB 110. As you heard, social workers play a critical role in Alaska's health and behavioral health systems. Across the state, social workers serve in schools, hospitals, tribal health organizations, child welfare programs, community mental health organizations, and rural clinics. Yet, like many states, particularly ones with the geographic realities of Alaska, we face persistent workforce shortages and challenges in connecting communities with the care that they need. The Social Work Licensing Compact offers a practical, modern solution that helps address these barriers while maintaining strong public protections. First and foremost, the compact expands access to care, which is needed right now. It does this by allowing licensed social workers in participating states, which as of yesterday, I believe is 32 or 33 states, to practice across state lines. It increases the pool of qualified professionals who can provide services to Alaskans. This is especially important for telehealth services, which has become an essential tool for reaching rural and remote communities. Second, the compact supports workforce mobility and recruitment. Licensed social workers would be able to practice in multiple compact states without having to repeat lengthy and duplicative licensing processes. This helps Alaska recruit experienced professionals and allows Alaska licensees to maintain continuity of care for clients who move or may receive services across state lines. Third, the compact strengthens public protection, which is the purpose of licensing. It does this kind of what Caitlin was saying by creating shared data systems among member states, allowing our licensing boards to quickly access information on licensing statuses, investigations, and disciplinary actions. That coordination improves transparency and enhances the ability of states to protect the public while maintaining their authority over professional regulation. And finally, the compact provides important support for military families. Military spouses in licensed professions often face major barriers to employment when relocating every few years. The compact allows military social workers and their spouses to maintain a home state license and continue working when stationed in another participating state. supporting both family stability and military readiness. At its core, the compact is about improving access to care, strengthening the workforce, and modernizing professional licensing in today's reality. It does this while preserving Alaska's licensing authority and giving our state an additional tool to meet the growing behavioral health needs of our community. Our chapter respectfully urges the committee to support the bill and help ensure that Alaskans have greater access to the professional social work services they need. And I'll say personally, it feels more fitting than ever that this bill is moving right now, which is National Social Work Month. The Social Work Licensing Compact will be the most consequential regulatory bill for our profession since licensing was enacted, and your leadership will be felt for generations to come. So thank you for your commitment to the health and well-being of Alaska communities, and I am also willing to answer any questions that you all might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brejak. Any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, thanks again for joining us today. With us in the audience is indeed Sylvan Robb, the Division Director of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing. Ms. Robb, would you join us, please? Could you please just provide for us from your perspective how this compact will work and how it will change things as far as licensing social workers in the state of Alaska?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. So this compact is structured, as the sponsor said, so that individuals who live in a member state, if they choose, may obtain a multi-state license if they meet those qualifications, and then they can practice in any one of the member compact states on that multi-state license. And so the impact that it will have for us is that it will reduce unnecessary licensure. It will make it easier for folks to come up and practice in Alaska without needing to get licensed here if they are coming from a member state and hold a multi-state license. It's certainly worth noting that anyone who is interested, the single state license in Alaska is still available. So anyone who's interested in that or might not qualify for a multi-state license would still be able to obtain an Alaska license and practice here. And happy to answer any other questions.
Understood. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do social workers that get the single state license now, do they pay a license fee to the state?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, they do. So all of our professional licensees pay a fee that covers the regulatory cost for their particular profession. Currently, a single state license is the only option. So until such time as we join the compact, that's what's out there. And those license fees are adjusted as the cost for regulation shift. Most of the shifts are related to investigations costs.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Indeed.
If they can get a multi-state license, will they still be paying a fee to Alaska, or will they pay it to the compact entity?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar. So if a person is a resident of Alaska, once we become a member of the compact and they opt to get a multi-state license issued by Alaska, then they will pay a fee for that multi-state license. If somebody is licensed, has a multi-state license in another state, then they will have paid fees to their home state or however they fund licensure regulation in that state. To kind of address your question from earlier, Senator, about the impact, so the cost of the license is related to the cost of the regulation. And so if we are issuing fewer licenses, then we see our costs go down because we have fewer things to process. And so won't have a negative impact on the ability to cover the regulatory costs.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
So if someone with a multi-state license commits a violation, is the investigation done by the multi-state entity or by Alaska, if it's done in Alaska, the violation?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar. When a social worker is treating someone in Alaska, be they an Alaska resident or somebody who's here visiting, they need to abide by Alaska statutes and regulations. If that individual committed a violation and we received a complaint, then we would investigate. if we are not the home state, so if somebody is practicing on their multi-state license from another state, we can't impact their home state license, but we can say you are no longer welcome to practice here in Alaska.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Indeed.
So who pays for that investigation? That is to say, if someone in a different state is holding this multi-state license, they allegedly commit a violation in Alaska, is the home state going to compensate Alaska for that investigation, or will it fall on whoever is living in Alaska with Alaskan licenses paying, you know, paying the state to sort of subsidize that investigation?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, if you will forgive me, I will get back to you on that. we have 7 compacts that are in front of the legislature at this point, and I feel like I have the answer, but I want to ensure that I am speaking to this compact and not one of the other 6. Most of the compacts are structured to ensure that we're not seeing fees covered by Alaskans for others. The other thing worth noting is that the multi-state license requirements are very stringent. You can't have had discipline against your license. So for the most part, to be colloquial, you kind of need to be squeaky clean to qualify for that multi-state license. And we have reached out to inquire for some of the other compacts. This compact is not active yet, but to see if people have seen an increase in their investigation fees once they have joined compacts. And we have not heard reports of that, again, because all of the compacts have this really high bar to say you can only use the compact. Depending on how it's structured, but in this case, you can only get a multi-state license if you are have never had any issues.
Final, Mr. Chair. So in general, I like the idea of having this kind of portability. I like the bill. What I'm concerned about is I know there are boards and commissions, where their primary costs are investigations, or close to their primary cost, and one investigation can be very expensive. And what I'm concerned about, what I don't want to see happen, is where whoever is paying into the Alaskan board residing in Alaska, or paying that solo fee you're talking about, now see higher fees because they are subsidizing investigations into the behavior of folks who are not paying Alaskans fees or for these boards. Is that clear? Does that make sense?
Yes, and through the chair to Senator Dunbar. So, again, this compact is, while it is enacted because enough states have joined that it exists, it is not active, so no one is issuing licenses under this compact yet. Most of the compacts offer the ability for a state to charge somebody who's coming, and so we can ensure that licensees from out of state are not paying those costs. Additionally, I would say that, you know, our biggest expense is for staff to process applications. We certainly have had a few boards where there are examples of big increases in investigation fees that have been really felt by licensees. The smaller the number of licensees, the more impactful that is. This is not one of our tiny professions. There's just an economy of scale that comes with that that helps. But again, our biggest cost is usually staffing. And as we have less processing, that reduces the need for staff. And just to be clear, we have plenty of other uses for staff. So I do know some staff listen to hearings, and we got plenty of work for people to do. So there should be no concern.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Thank you, Director Robb. Any further questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing and hearing none, Representative Gray, anything in wrap-up?
No, thank you so much for hearing the bill today, Chair Bjorkman and committee. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, we will be hearing a number of other compact bills, a bit of a compact-a-palooza here this year in response to the Rural Health Care Transformation Program. So it's good that we ask the questions and figure out which compacts do what and when. So we'll be doing more of that. We're going to set Senate Bill 110 aside for further consideration at a future hearing and roll right into our last item, which is HCR 20, brought to us by Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson, you've been here for the long haul today here at Senate Labor and Commerce. We greatly appreciate your patience, and now it will be rewarded by a first hearing on this item. With us to present the bill is the representative and his staff. Could you please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation?
Thank you, Senator Brockman. I am just a glutton for punishment, so I love sitting through Senate Labor and Commerce. Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, it is an honor being here presenting House Joint Resolution number 20. For the record, I am Representative David Nelson, serving House District 18, which is Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, Government Hill, and small part of East Anchorage. Thank you for the opportunity for House Joint Resolution 20 to be heard, as encouraging the United States Congress to establish hiring goals for apprentices and veteran apprentices. Really, the resolution aims to assist veterans who are preparing to transition from the armed services to civilian life. According to the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2024, 60% of unemployed veterans were between the ages of 25 and 64, meaning the majority of those unemployed veterans are in their prime working age. These veterans are rigorously trained by the Department of Defense and are skilled and motivated, making them highly valuable in the workforce. House Joint Resolution number 20 would encourage Congress to establish hiring goals for domestic Department of Defense construction projects, namely for individuals who are participating in qualified apprenticeships or post-secondary programs. These hiring goals would be no less than 10% of the total workforce employed of the project, with no less than 10% of those being veterans. Promoting the inclusion of veterans in DOD-funded construction projects would enhance the workforce, with individuals who are accustomed to working in complex and demanding environments. This would create a solid foundation for countless individuals who have protected and served our great country. I urge the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to ask Congress to establish these hiring goals to support those who wore the uniform in defense of the United States. And if it is the will of the committee, there is also a couple of testifiers willing to expand on this further.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor or staff? Seeing and hearing none, we'll go to invited testifier, Mr. David Gilbert. Mr. Gilbert, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, good afternoon, my name is David Gilbert. I'm a retired United States Army combat veteran. I served our country for 20 years before retiring in 2021 from the Army. After retiring, I chose to make Alaska my home because I wanted to continue building a life and contribute to the communities here. I am currently an apprentice electrician with the IBEW Local 1547 here in Alaska. I chose the electrical trade because it allows me to keep learning, work as a part of a team, and help build the infrastructure our companies or communities depend on. During my 2 decades in the Army, I worked alongside men and women who demonstrated skills and discipline, teamwork, leadership, and the ability to solve problems under pressure. Those same qualities translate directly into the skilled trades in the construction industry. When I retired in 2021, I experienced something many veterans face. After 20 years of having a mission every day, stepping into the civilian world felt uncertain. I knew I had valuable skills in leadership, accountability, and teamwork, but figuring out how those skills fit in the civilian careers was not always clear. For me, entering the trades and beginning my apprenticeship gave me a new mission. It allowed me to continue working with a team and contribute to my community by helping build the infrastructure that supports our state. But not every veteran finds that path easily. Alaska is home to tens of thousands of veterans, many of whom have skills, work ethic, and leadership employers are looking for. At the same time, our state continues to face serious workforce shortages in construction and skilled trades, especially as we look forward towards future infrastructure and development projects. HJR 20 helps connect those two realities, encouraging contractors working on federal construction projects to ensure that at least 10% of their workforce is made up of veterans is a practical and responsible step. It recognizes the value that veterans bring to the table while also helping them transition into stable, well-paying, and meaningful careers. Veterans understand discipline, safety standards, teamwork, and accountability. These qualities align naturally with the expectations of the construction industry and the skilled trades. Policies like HJR 20 help ensure that veterans who have spent years serving their country are given meaningful opportunities to continue serving their communities here at home. I respectfully encourage the legislature to support this resolution and continue strengthening pathways that help veterans transition successfully into Alaska's skilled workforce. And we invest in veterans. We invest in people who have already proven they're committed to the mission. Thank you for your time and for your continued support of Alaska's veterans.
Excellent. Any questions for Mr. Gilbert? Hearing and seeing none, we'll move to our next invited testifier, Manny Acuna. Mr. Acuna, please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Manny Acuna, and I'm an Air Force veteran of 13 years and a wireman instructor at the Alaska Joint Electrical Apprenticeship Training Trust with 10 years in the trade. I strongly support House Joint Resolution 20 because it completes the transition cycle for veterans seeking careers in the construction trades. My Air Force experience translated directly to my success as a wireman, working in aircraft maintenance, gave me mechanical, technical, electrical, and safety skills that provided a clear advantage when I entered the trade. Familiarity with base personnel, flight line layout, and holding a secret security clearance also proved valuable. Those connections and operational knowledge helped projects run smoother and allowed me to integrate into teams more quickly. That real-world continuity is exactly what registered apprenticeships can and should provide for other veterans. Here's why this approach works. First, require DOD contractors on military construction projects to use DOL registered apprenticeships. Registered programs guarantee on-the-job training and supervised classroom instruction, giving people with little or no experience the time and structure to learn a trade. That directly addresses chronic workforce shortages by building a skilled pipeline instead of relying on short-term untrained labor. Second, set targeted hiring goals for veteran apprentices. Veterans bring discipline, technical aptitude, and reliability, but many lack a clear civilian pathway. If a portion of apprenticeships is reserved for or targeted for veterans, it opens the door for those transitioning from service. Registered apprenticeship standards protect those veterans. They gain portable credentials and real career mobility rather than being stuck in informal on-the-job training that can leave them vulnerable and exploitation or vulnerable to exploitation. Third, link awarded contractors with transition programs. Many veterans, especially those from combat arms, need preparatory training before entering an apprenticeship. Coordinating DOD awarded contractors with existing transition programs creates a predictable pathway. Transition training equals enrollment in DOL registered apprenticeship, which equals placement on the job. This completes the cycle using funding already allocated to DOD construction projects. There are important side benefits for DOD and the nation as well. Reduced unemployment costs. When veterans leave the military unemployed, the service branch bears those costs. Lower VA costs. Employed veterans with private health care coverage reduce demand on VA resources and lower per veteran costs to the VA. Improved veteran well-being. Stable employment lowers suicide risk and supports healthier transitions to civilian life. And stronger recruitment. If veterans see the military as a pathway to post-service opportunity, they and their communities are more likely to encourage service, improving recruitment over time. This resolution is a common sense, low cost step. It doesn't impose new large programs, but directs federal hiring and procurement practices to leverage existing apprenticeship infrastructure and transition resources. Passing HJR 20 will help DOD complete the transition cycle, honor service, and strengthen both our workforce and communities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Acuna. Our final invited testifier for today is Mr. Chris Diamond. Mr. Diamond, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee. My name is Chris Diamond. I serve as the representative for the Western States Carpenters Union here in Alaska. I've personally benefited from the apprenticeship system. The career I've built, the ability to support my family, and the work I do today all started because someone gave me the opportunity to enter a registered apprenticeship program. Apprenticeships work because it connects training directly to real work. Instead of asking people to take on debt and hope there's a job waiting for them afterwards, you know, i.e. college, federally registered apprenticeships allow people to earn while they're learning. They gain real-life skills, real wages and benefits, and an industry-recognized credential that can support a lifelong career. And that pathway matters deeply in Alaska, where we rely heavily on skilled trades to build and maintain our infrastructure. Apprenticeships are not just good for workers. They're a smart investment for employers and for our economy as a whole. A recent U.S. Department of Labor study examined the return on investment for employers who train apprentices, and that study found that employers ultimately receive approximately $1.44 in value for every $1 invested in apprenticeship training, with the typical employer gaining more than $17,000 in net benefit per apprenticeship that they have invested their time in training. That return comes from higher productivity and safety, lower turnover, and dependable pipeline of skilled workers. You know, these people put down roots in their communities when they're going to a federally registered apprenticeship. These apprenticeships aren't charity. It's a workforce development that actually pays off. HJR 20 recognizes that reality. This resolution encourages Congress to require 10% apprenticeship on DOD construction projects and 10% of those apprentices to be veterans. And veterans are fantastic apprentices. This is a common sense, achievable goal. Military construction projects require thousands of skilled workers across this country and in Alaska, and federally recognized apprenticeship programs ensure those workers are properly trained while building the next generation of workforce that we all need. Including veterans in those apprenticeship goals makes even more sense. Like I said, they're fantastic apprentices, and they turn into a fantastic journeyman. Veterans into the military with discipline, leadership skills, and extensive technical training, and apprenticeships provide a structured pathway for these men and women to transition and experience that turn into stable, long-term civilian careers. Here in Alaska, that opportunity matters greatly. Nearly 14% of our adult population are veterans, which is the highest percentage in the nation. We should be doing everything that we can to ensure that these men and women that have served our country get career opportunities when they return home or exit their service. From my own experience, federally recognized apprenticeships do more than train workers. They build careers, they strengthen our families, and they create a skilled workforce that continue to build our communities and teach the next generation of apprentices. HJR 20 supports that model, while helping to connect veterans with meaningful work and ensuring our infrastructure projects are helping to train the next generation of skilled workforce. I come from an organization that has been doing this for almost 150 years, and it has proven extremely successful. And if we want Alaska and our veterans to succeed in the industries that build our country and our local economies, then we need to be expanding opportunities like this every chance we get. And for those reasons, I respectfully urge the community to support this resolution, and I thank you for your time and consideration. I would be happy to answer any questions anybody may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Diamond. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, are there any questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Nelson, anything in wrap-up?
No, not right at this time, Mr. Chair.
Very well. This time we will set HJR 20 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. This concludes our business at the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee today. We will meet again on Monday of next week. Under bills previously heard or scheduled, I am adding Senate Bill 249, virtual currency kiosks, to our agenda for Monday. Following that, we will hear Senate Bill 226, homemade food, reduced oxygen packaging, Senate Bill 111, digital product repair, Senate Bill 185, insurance rebates advertising. Please note that on Monday we will be starting our meeting 1/2 hour later than usual. We will gavel in at 2 p.m. on Monday because the Department of Labor Budget Subcommittee will begin at 1 p.m. As there is no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee today, we are adjourned at 3:24 p.m.